We need more people in serious roles shitposting on Twitter. It's fun for everyone.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Web3 Builders. I'm Evan Van Ness. I'm here with Will, and we are here with Harrison from Gaslight, also known as Pop Punk on Chain on Twitter. Probably needs no introduction. As I just found out off camera, he is crushing it on Twitter with not that many followers. He is doing like 10x the impressions per month that I am. So, you know, I'm just orders of magnitude behind him on, you know, views for, per follower, I guess, is would be that metric. Harrison, let's start by just like standard podcast question. Like, what is the very first moment that you heard about Ethereum?
Yeah, so I think the very first moment I heard about Ethereum was probably my sophomore year of college in 2015. I guess it was shortly after it came out, where I had a kid in my dorm that was buying stuff on some nefarious websites on the internet. As I've actually heard a lot of people have similar stories, but he was basically like, yeah, so I buy Ethereum. I use a Tumblr, which back then I'm like, oh, a Tumblr, that means like you can't trace it and stuff anymore. Now, you know, knowing that it was not Tornado Cash. But yeah, he just like explained it and said what he was doing with it. And I started to look more into it. And I just started like buying ETH like slowly whenever I had money, which was, I was in college, I was poor. I was making $10 an hour as a TA. So whenever I had just like spare money that I wasn't spending on beer, I was buying ETH. And I mean, yeah, it just really snowballed from there.
Were you, what year was this?
So this was 2015 and 2016, and then I graduated in 2017.
And so you graduated from college. What do you go off and do from there?
So I graduated with a computer science degree. For some reason, I was like really interested in working at a hedge fund. So I got a job at a hedge fund and just like immediately realized that was a bad decision.
You seem like a super hedge fund guy to me, like in the background.
It was rough. Like, I didn't realize I'd have to like actually wear a suit to work, to just like sit at a desk and write like Python and like PowerShell scripts. But the interesting thing was, even though I didn't like the work, I got really lucky, and my entire team there was also super into crypto, just like trading it, like reading about it. So yeah, like I stayed there because I really liked the team. I was there for like 6 or 7 months. Like, it was a super short stint, and then I just tried to get like deeper and deeper into crypto. I eventually landed at Gemini in 2019, where I worked for 2 years working on like the trading engine, stuff like that. But I, you know, at the end of the day, like, I wanted to get deeper in crypto. I wanted to write smart contracts and stuff, but I was just doing Web2 dev there. Like, it's really no different than if I worked at like New York Stock Exchange or something writing code, because, you know, yes, the assets on the exchange were crypto, but I wasn't interfacing with any of that. So yeah, and that's when I hopped from Gemini, super short stint at some like random fintech company. And then I finally was like, all right, I want to get into crypto. I want to get into Web3. How the hell do I do this? Because I've noticed that, you know, anyone can, you know, pick up an IDE and write code, but I wanted to do it like the professional route. Like, I wanted to have a job at a Web3 company. And I knew that like, it's a little bit gatekept. I might have to do something that I don't want to do. So I hate full stack development more than anything. I hate JavaScript. I hate TypeScript, but I see a job opening at a super small protocol called Homecoin Finance.
I like this guy.
Yeah, so I literally take the job, and for 9 months, I'm writing React like version 16. Like, there's no like hooks or any, no use effect. But I'm doing this. I hate it, but I'm like, this is my cheat code, because like, now I'm getting experience at one of these companies, so I'm more reputable. So now I had to think about like, how do I go from this now to actually writing smart contracts? So I went to ETH Denver in 2021, wrote my first ever smart contract, absolutely fell in love with it. The project is actually funny. The project was, it was hierarchical on-chain royalties that we were like targeting towards like open source projects. At the end of the day, it was fully a pyramid scheme, but our project was called NAPS, which stood for Not a Pyramid Scheme. It won some bounties. That was super cool. And from there, I'm like, all right, I have experience, you know, writing Solidity. I put basically every single waking minute of my life outside of work hours and weekends into writing smart contracts. And then I landed at Magna, which is a token distribution platform, where I led protocol engineering there for almost a year leading up to me starting Gaslight.
Okay, so let's digress for a second. Yes. I got to ask, what hedge fund? Because I'm curious, like, which back, even back then, that they were already.
Yes. So I worked at AQR Capital.
Okay, so that's Asnes, right?
Yep, Cliff Asnes.
Okay, yeah, the famous, the only free lunch in finance is diversification. but yeah, it's huge now. I mean, it's like they have a whole bunch of mutual funds as well, products, right? So, you know, they're massive. But the sort of the back office tech staff was already into crypto, or the finance pros too, even back then.
So my team was like a bunch of just like random software engineers. We all did like kind of different stuff on the team. But one of the guys said he was like mining like Bitcoin in like the Howard University computer lab that he was like the lab manager of like way early on, probably like, well, way early on, being like maybe like 2012, 2013.
These days you get arrested for that.
Yeah, but he was like, it was amazing. And he was like this Trinidadian guy. He had like an amazing accent. Just like the stories that he would tell us. He was like, I remember selling tens of thousands of Bitcoin super early on to buy like silly tech for my dorm stuff.
Yeah. And you were mostly writing Python? That surprised me, because like, I mean, Python for data analysis, but I mean, I feel like if you need the speed, you usually end up in C or C++ or something like that.
Well, I was like a pretty unimportant engineer there. I wasn't writing like quant strategies and stuff. We were doing some like light analysis, a little bit of like pandas, but it was mostly just like Flask, like backend APIs to like make data more accessible for like the less technical people. And then just random PowerShell scripts to like automate processes on like their 2007 Windows servers.
And is that anything that you thought you were going to be doing when you were getting a comp sci degree?
I mean, to me, like, I was super excited because, like, I remember, like, right before I started, I watched, like, a season of the show Billions, and I'm like, it's going to be super fast-paced. It's going to be amazing. And then I joined, and I'm like, why am I wearing a suit and drinking, like, Diet Coke in, like, a cubicle all day?
Yeah, right on. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to dig in was you said it's sort of gate-kept. And I think I've seen you say that before, maybe like a year and some ago. That's really sad to me, actually, because like the whole idea is supposed to be that it's not like that. Do you mean that like it's gatekept in the sense of like getting these jobs is hard because it's hard to figure out who's actually good at Solidity? Or
yeah. So there's sort of like a couple points to it. So like it's not gatekept in the sense where like anyone can like write their own stuff, can deploy an NFT contract, can like make money and stuff that way. But like, if you want to really go the professional route, you want to get like a job as like a protocol engineer or something at like a reputable company, it's really hard to do. And especially like at that point that I was getting into it, because it's like a lot of companies don't really want to hire like a junior protocol engineer or someone with zero experience, because obviously, you know, money's at risk. They want to hire someone that has actual professional experience writing smart contracts and, you know, have deployed a number of contracts that have facilitated, you know, millions of dollars. But it's like, how do you get to that point if you're not already doing that at a company? And that's something that I've noticed. Like when I was leading protocol engineering at Magno, we would get tons and tons and tons of applications for people that like would apply for like a senior level job, but they didn't have like their credentials, and they're like, please just look at it. And like, even now I get so many DMs, probably like, it's not an understatement to say maybe 10 to 20 DMs a day of people just asking me like, how did you get into it? Like, how did you land a job at an actual company doing this?
And so what was the secret to you getting that job? Like, was it just that you'd gone deep enough down the rabbit hole from East Denver that you had stuff you could point to on?
So, I mean, it was like a mixture of like, I did have experience like working at a crypto company. I was doing like at the closest I was getting to the blockchain was like writing like Web3.js and like Ether's like calls and stuff. So it was like I had familiarity with like how a dApp works. But then the amount of time that I put into learning Solidity, I watched Patrick Collins' entire, I think that's the 32-hour course. The new one is the 27. But I watched that entire course like three times. I went through all of like Crypto Zombies. I read like all the audit reports from like the big firms. I read like every single smart contract for every dApp that like I had ever interacted with. And I'd like to say that I aped into it is an understatement. Like I was up until like 3, 4 a.m. every night, waking up in the morning, working. And I think that's really how I was able to go from, you know, just writing silly, dumb JavaScript at a company to actually leading protocol engineering at a company in like 3.5 months.
That's super impressive. How did that compare to like a lot of the comp sci degrees kids get nowadays, and then like learning actually Web3 development. Because I think there's a lot of people come into the space like every bull cycle who are comp sci kids and get super excited by it. And then I never know what the trajectory for them is. It's like, it's even available, or do they have to double down on what you did?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure like fully, because like I don't really know anyone that's like graduating college now. Most honestly, the most of the people that I like work with nowadays, and like some of the best developers that I've met, are either, you know, studied something completely different in college, or like dropped out and are just self-taught. I definitely think that if I was going to do everything over again, I probably wouldn't go to college and just like wouldn't study computer science. But I think that the path a lot of times seems to just be like, if you really want to like succeed and, you know, land a solid job in this industry, you have to put in like a ton of time just learning on your own, because the odds of landing like a really junior or like early stage job in this industry, I think it's so hard, especially because the space is blowing up. More and more people every single day want to get into it. Like, just look at how many, you know, security auditors there are now. There's probably five times as many auditors as devs. So I just think it's a super competitive space.
I'm curious about any false starts you had when you were going down that Solidity rabbit hole. Like, what didn't work?
I mean, it was definitely super tough. Like, the actual language of Solidity to me was just like really like nothing I'd written before, because I was just writing like a bunch of Python, like some super functional Scala and stuff like that, some Kotlin. But yeah, I would say like the language of Solidity was probably the only tough thing to me. But like, I just was willing to like put so much time into it to just like get past that. But other than that, really no like pitfalls.
If you were going back and doing it again, do you feel like there is some like Pareto principle where you got 80% of the result from 20% of the effort in all of this? Like, is there one thing that worked better than others, like reading audit reports?
Yeah, I mean, I think that reading audit reports is definitely super, super important, because you're actually like starting to get exposure to like really, really complex smart contracts and stuff like that. Like, I would read like Uniswap's audit reports and stuff like that. And it's good to like kind of like throw something that's like way over your head at you and try and learn from that, as opposed to like, there are still like a lot of like courses and stuff that you can take, or like paid Udemy courses, where it's like, okay, like your curriculum is to write a lottery smart contract and then like a super simple escrow smart contract. And at the end, they're like, all right, you're ready. Like, go get a job.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea that you could become a junior Solidity developer, I mean, I don't like, yeah, it's, there basically is no job. I'm not sure when there will be, frankly. I mean, it's,
I don't know.
we're still very early on that one.
Yeah, I mean, we did something really, really interesting though at Gaslight. So we had an intern for the summer, and the goal was to take someone who has absolutely zero experience with Solidity and teach them how to like do gas optimization audits of smart contracts. And that was a super interesting process. Definitely, you know, obviously we're taking someone who's pretty much barely ever looked at Solidity smart contracts, and it was fun to like explain really like how the EVM works and like teach them Solidity, but like almost on the side. And it's like, have them first focus on like how the EVM works, like look at smart contracts. They might even not like fully understand them, but like start to point out like patterns and stuff with like gas optimization and things that we fix. And then our intern Eliza was like learning it on the side. And I think it was an amazing experience.
Did you learn anything in particular about how to make that happen? Like, just focus on the EVM and...
Yeah, I mean, I think that the EVM is super important, obviously, because at the end of the day, like, you can write, you know, your Solidity, your smart contracts, deploy them, but, like, what good is it if you don't really, like, understand what's going on behind the scenes? Like, obviously, for other languages, like, it's fine if you don't know how, like, the Java virtual runtime or whatever works, or, like, the Python interpreter, because, like, it's not that big of a deal, but, like, with Solidity, money's usually on the line. Like, there's... like optimization to be done. Like, you might not realize, like, if you just jump in and like write some crazy nested for loop, that a transaction could cost $1,000 to like just like that.
So one thing that you are sort of known for is, or I guess you've had a few tweets about lately, is saying that you think that some of the smaller audit jobs are better for the money, or that's who you'd use.
I think it's really a blend of all of them. So like when I worked at Magna, I did audits with many different companies. Pretty sure before I joined, they were doing audits with Certic, but that switched real fast. Did audits with like Trailbits, Celic, OtterSec, like some really like medium to like really large prominent sized auditors. And then after I left there, I started anything that I wanted audited, I would go to a solo auditor and like we work with Pashov Crum, who's arguably one of the best solo auditors like in the world, on Gaslight stuff. And it's sort of just like a really more positive experience, in my opinion. Obviously, I think a lot of these solo auditors work ridiculously hard, and I think they might be putting in more time than a lot of these audit firms. That's not to say all of them, but they're really, really hardworking, and they're personable, and like the back and forth that you can have with them is great. And at the end of the day too, like, you could go to an audit firm that would charge you $50,000 a week and you'd have like a 2-week audit, spend $100,000, or you could get a similar, if not better, job done from a solo auditor for a third of the price. So I think it's really a blend of like the work ethic, like the responsiveness, and the price.
Did you ever have like an experience where you tried to negotiate who it would be, or reading people's individual audits before you like accepted them as their?
Yeah. So I don't want to name the firm, but there was a case where at my prior company, we did audits with two different companies, the same company, but on two different occasions. And on one of the audits, the audit quality was super great, super responsive. But in one of the other occasions, the second one actually, the audit was terrible. It was like pretty much facilitated fully through Telegram. We didn't even get like a pre-audit report or like a final report until we asked for it like weeks and weeks later. So this is kind of like the reverse of like, I actually had a really positive experience the first time, and I wish I should have known to ask for the same people the second time. Because the second time, like, it was basically like I got an A+ audit the first time and like a D- audit the second time.
Curious about like the number of audits and like pricing for this sort of stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of like security audits, like in the past when I had like was writing smart contracts and we would get them audited at Magno, we only had a couple smart contracts. So we just typically did one round of audits with one auditing firm. But a lot of these bigger, you know, protocols with substantially higher budgets, like VC funding and stuff, like a lot of them, like, especially like I was surprised to find out that like companies that I work with now on gas audits, they'll do a gas audit and then they'll do a solo auditor reviews their code, and then they'll do like a code arena. And then after the code arena, they'll do a firm audit. So it's like three levels of that. I believe that BadgerDAO, I think, did that recently where they went through like so many different rounds of audits. I think that's great. Obviously, like, you're spending a lot of money, but in terms of safety, it's insane because like we read all these like instances where auditors, even top tier auditing firms, like, they can miss like a vulnerability. Like, obviously no one's perfect. Even like the best firms, the best auditors can still miss stuff. So I think the line of defense is great. You just have to have a lot of money for that.
Yeah. And frankly, like, I have read some audit reports from big firms where like they will tell you in coded terms, like, we didn't find everything. And we know we didn't find everything, right? We only had a couple of weeks, and you know, like, this code base is a work in progress and is not ready for production. And it's sort of interesting because, you know, a lot of times these protocols then go say like, look, like, Trail of Bits audited us. And then I read the report and Trail of Bits is like, that's an amusing thing. And it gets to like, the market is really inefficient for these auditors. That was one of the questions I had for you, because, you know, you've gone on this crusade against Certiq, which I think you're a hero for, because like I've been bothered by the fact that the market is extremely inefficient, but I just haven't really wanted to like say anything. And it's objectively true that, you know, like they have been, the things that they have audited have been hacked a crazy amount, but like when there's that much of a pattern and objectively like the audit report is not good, and that is actually not a seal of approval, I don't know, like, how do we make the market more efficient? I mean, is there anyone else that you'd like to name and shame?
So I guess in terms of like auditors, the only people I really like think are worth name and shaming is Certiq. And it's always crazy because, you know, I've garnered thousands of likes, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of impressions at this point talking about Certiq. And I've only had one person replying defending them. And it's an account with two followers that a bunch of their likes are just Certiq stuff. So I don't want to make any accusations, but it's like, it's known that like Certiq is putting out really poor quality audits. They're just churning them out. And it's tough because like they'll make like defenses and stuff. Like I want to bring up the Z Casino thing from recently. I'm not sure. For anyone that doesn't know, basically there was this like ZK gambling app. They posted something really egregious, like a really offensive, like fucked up meme on Twitter. And then Lawrence replied, and he's like, I'm waiting for you to like get exploited or something crazy like that. And they're like, good luck. And then the next day they disclosed that they had a vulnerability. And it was basically something that was in Certix audit report, but they flagged it as informative, meaning it's not really an issue. The team didn't even do anything to fix it. And Certix was like, look, we pointed this out. But the thing is, like, the issue boiled down to, like, they were using Chainlink VRF to generate, like, random words. And it has a thing where it's, like, if over the course of, I think they had it set to 200 blocks, if they can't, like, get the words back or whatever, like, if gas is high for 200 blocks, the user can refund their bet. So Certix was like, oh, yeah, if the blockchain is super congested, like, this could happen. Whereas they didn't mention the fact that this could very easily be artificially done by someone. So like we did, me and some friends did some calculations, and on Polygon, it would basically cost $6,000 to place a bet that if you weren't going to win, you could instantly take back. So essentially you're infinitely winning. So based on like that information, this should have been marked as a critical vulnerability. Had Certix have marked it as a critical vulnerability, Zcasino 100% would have fixed it. But because they were just like, blah, 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 if the network is busy, this could maybe happen. This happens.
It was on Polygon. Okay, that's the bit I didn't realize. Yeah, so it's, I mean, it's an economic attack. That's fascinating. No, go ahead.
Side note, I love how you mentioned drinking Diet Cokes and even ripping a White Claw. Where is that Celsius?
It's a Celsius.
Okay. I was like, yeah, that's good. It's a good change of pace.
Did you do any of the like the Securiums or... No. Any of these other boot camps? No.
Okay. No, so I didn't do any boot camps and stuff. I basically like I learned and like got into gas optimization by looking at previous contracts that were written before I joined Magna by like interns and contractors. And it really just started as like me refactoring like one of the contracts. And I like learned about like the hard hat gas reporting feature at the time we were using hard hat. I'm like, I almost started to like gamify it. And it's like, how much can I make the gas go down here and here? Like, I want to see number go down. So I like randomly started to tweet about it, blew up from like zero to 10K in like a couple months. There were always people that were like interested in gas, but weren't really like ripping companies for being inefficient and like posting a lot of tips and tricks. And that just scaled to like, I would write threads and companies just started to like DM me and they're like, hey, do you want to review our code? And literally like the gas audit was born from there.
So what's the pipeline like now? Like, do you have more than you can handle if just people just want
to? Yes. So we're like pretty much fully booked all through October. Like already we have like people lining up. We have to start taking deposits. So we know that people are like really serious about it. And the craziest thing is we're pretty much turning down about 75% of people that reach out to us just because we're at a point where we can have a really premium pricing model. So we have to like weigh the pros and cons. If like a company comes to us, they have a ton of lines of code, we give them a quote and they can afford to pay like a fifth of that. Like it sucks. We have to turn them away. We're turning them away to zero. We don't have competitors. So it's like, it's unfortunate, but we have to like basically spend our time where it's the most important. And that's why we have a lot of stuff in the mix for Gaslight in the future, in the very, very near future.
Tell us a little bit about like hiring and like the dynamics of Twitter. We've complained a lot about Twitter on this show because it's, I guess we're not getting as many likes or we're not as funny as we thought we once were. But in terms of like building a business, are you finding it still to be a useful place for you? And then tell me a little bit about like hiring and bringing in like new Web3 builders in the midst of a bear market.
Yeah, I mean, like I literally credit the entire birth and success of Gaslight to Twitter. Like so far, every single protocol that we've ever worked with has come through a cold Twitter DM to me just saying like, hey, we saw your tweet. Do you want to work with us? We've never done outreach. We have no BD person. No one's out there cold, you know, DMing protocols saying, hey, like, do you want a gas audit? It's all just been organic growth. And I think it's super important. And like, as I continue to build this brand and like build the company, we're, you know, very quickly going to be at the point where it's like, we can't like, I, you know, me, myself, like alone and like maybe contracting a couple people, like we just don't have enough bandwidth for the amount of interest in the gas audits. So like on our future roadmap, like we want to have people doing BD, we want people reaching out, but that means we're going to have an exponential more amount of audits. So we're definitely going to be scaling the team. And the really interesting thing about that is like, not that many people are into gas optimization, but I run a group chat called Optimization Fans with 100 of like the best devs like in the world. And we just shitpost and talk about gas optimization all the time. So I know that like when the time comes and I need to scale the team, like I already have a pool of like at least out of those 100, like 30 hyper qualified people to bring on.
So that's basically you have that group chat and that's how you've found your contractors and that is your future employees. That's
pretty brilliant. Much, yeah. Like, and it's also interesting. Like the goal for that was never really that. I just wanted to like put like all the like minds really in the same room, like people that are, you know, conscious about gas, network health and stuff like that. And then, you know, my co-founder and I just kept talking about it and it's like, holy shit. Like when we scaled, like, did we accidentally like build like the perfect candidate pool for us? And it turns out we did.
How do you balance the security versus the gas optimization when you are doing your audits, right?
Yeah. So me personally, I do zero security auditing. Like the only time I'll make like a recommendation if I see something like egregious, but like I don't really have like that mind to think about like security in a way where like I feel like I know enough about security auditing to charge for that. But we have a ton of customers that reach out and they're like, hey, we'd love like security and gas. And in those cases, we have solo auditors that we'll bring on and sort of like attack it with us and we'll split it with them. I think that's a really good approach. Like my goal isn't really to build like an auditing firm that's like a full security firm and a full like gas firm. My goal is to have like just an all-encompassing like gas company. And it's like the cases where somebody also wants gas, like I basically have a guy that I can bring in to work on that with us.
So when we saw like NFTs pop off, NFT mints and NFT dynamics have like are different than like the DeFi a lot of people got used to when they were building applications. So how do you think about that when you're like building the pipeline out? Have you seen like people becoming specialized in certain types of dApps when it comes to audits, or is it still like pretty generalistic? Anyone can kind of handle.
I mean, there is like a pretty. Like there's a little bit of specification and like people really like learning one thing really well. Like for example, 0x Saigar, he's really, really good at like security and gas optimization, like specifically on like NFT smart contracts and stuff. And there's a reason why he works with like basically every like blue chip NFT company when they drop something else. Like he has crazy experience with it and he just like knows like ERC 721A, that standard and everything really, really well. I'm not really sure of anyone else that really has it like honed in on like specifically DeFi. And it's just interesting for gas because every smart contract, like at the end of the day, is like really similar enough for us with gas audits. Like we're looking for like the first 20% of an audit is usually looking for the same things. And then it's just, we got to go through everything.
If I guess earlier it sort of sounded like, you know, sometimes you have customers that come to you first and then they do security after you've optimized it. Now you're saying, you also have people that come to you and ask for both, like
here's
my code base, I'm ready to ship, oh wait, like give me some security and some gas. How does that work? Like how do you work on that internally? I'm curious.
So like we do have like some firms that like they don't have their security audit lined up, like they're not doing a C4A, they haven't like put time on like an auditor's calendar. The people that haven't done that, if they're interested, like sometimes they'll be like, you do gas, do you also do security? And in those cases, we'll bring in a security auditor. But a lot of these other companies, they already have like their massive audit booked out for, you know, a month to 3 month long like audit with a big firm, but they come to us for gas first. And those are the cases where like we just do gas. I definitely recommend that everyone does gas before security just because nobody's perfect. Like my optimizations, like knock on wood to this day, have yet to introduce a security vulnerability. But I would always love, like I go into it, you go through a security audit, and then our pricing includes, we'll look at your code again after the security audit.
So even when you do like the gas and security together, it's basically you're doing the gas and then you're giving it to your guy that does the security.
Yeah.
Sort of. Like
Yeah.
Okay. Totally. That's what I wanted to.
I'm strictly just doing the gas.
Okay. I was curious, is there some like interweaving it in some weird way that I don't understand, but it didn't really make any sense to me. So it makes sense that the answer is no. I guess on that note, question from my list is, Brock Elmore has this, I don't know how he says it, free pie. It's his security pattern. When you read that, what do you feel? Because I know he calls out optimizers in the blog post.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like definitely I value security way more than optimization. Like security, I always hold to a higher regard. And that's why we optimize super, super safely. Like, we're not going in and like converting your entire code base to assembly. Obviously, if you didn't have assembly in your code beforehand, most likely it's for a reason you don't want it. So all of our optimization is really in security. There's a bunch of other misconceptions too. It's like, oh, you're going to make our code unreadable. But in most cases with gas optimization, your code is clearer and the logic is more evident because, you know, ideally we have less lines of code. The logic is less convoluted. And then the other thing is like, we're not going in there and removing like validation to make sure like, oh, like you were previously checking to see if these two array lengths were equal. Like that costs a little bit of gas. Like we're going to remove that. No, like there are definitely a lot of trade-offs that we make where the gas cost is slightly higher than we could theoretically make it. And that's because security is the most important thing. Like I've had this discussion a couple times with Patrick Collins, and like we're both on the same page that it's like the only time that gas is sometimes good is if you're leaving gas because security is more important in that sense.
So basically what I hear you saying is like, all right, you can have your gas good if you need that require statement exactly. To be sure of that invariant.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so not that actually that spicy on this one.
Yeah.
Today you tweeted about Milady Cola, who, you know, they balked at the price of your audit, and then they did a pretty gas-intensive whitelist instead of doing a Merkle root check. So, you know, I would call this like a, I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but a basic architectural decision that they got wrong. And versus, you know, like a tactical, you're in the weeds of the code and like, you know not to use this solidity, whatever, because it's slightly higher gas. I'm curious as to what, like when you find stuff, is it like, how often is it basic architecture versus tactical?
I mean, I would say the greater majority of the time, like probably 60 to 70% of the time, it's really simple stuff like that you just don't think about, because it's sort of like the same reason why like QA teams exist is like, you don't want the software engineers to also be writing like the tests in like these, whatever, like big companies, financial institutions, you want another set of eyes on it. And like, I'm even guilty of this sometimes too. Like I'll write a contract and I'll just like write it really quickly, overthink something. And I'm like, oh crap, like I could have optimized that. I think it's a lot easier to see these things when you're like an outside set of eyes looking in on someone else's work. But a lot of the times, yeah. And a lot of these things usually boil down to just like really critical mistakes made in like batch functions, like loops, like not realizing that like, oh, in a transaction, like you actually pay gas for a view function, things where it's like, oh, I could have cached this beforehand instead of recomputing every single time. So most of the time, these things are just like common silly mistakes, but they're really important because they go missed.
Like what's the worst gas example that would make a solidity, like a junior solidity developer, which doesn't really exist, as we said earlier, but that would make a solidity developer square?
The worst thing I ever saw in a smart contract, it was like probably back in like February, maybe, where I had like 200 followers, but it was like my first like quote unquote like viral tweet. And it was basically like a company that I saw that had a NFT contract where they could do batch mints. And their batch mint function accepted two arrays. It was an array of addresses and an array of amounts. And they did a for loop through, they basically did a nested for loop. So it's like, we're going to loop through each address, and then we're going to loop up to n many times that NFT should receive each time. Whereas this should have just been ERC-721A. And I did the benchmarks and stuff. And I'm pretty sure that my implementation was like 400 times cheaper than theirs. And I reached out to them and they were basically like, oh, we're just not going to use that smart contract. Thank you.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I want to bring up the PayPal story, which like you also tweeted about when they were launching their PayPal stablecoin. Obviously, we had that news like last week where they're like bringing it public now. Tell us like a little bit about that story. I'm also curious, like just thinking about like all the stuff you do for free, just by, I guess, to learn. And be curious to know if like you encourage people to go do that as part of like the process of being a developer in this space.
Yeah. So, I mean, definitely I'll answer the second part first. I think it's always important that like our space is evolving so, so quick, and like there's an endless amount of information and like nobody knows everything. So I like encourage, and like most devs that I know are just constantly learning. And it's like that phrase where it's like everyone in Web3 is terminally online, but it really is true that like people are always online. They're always like researching new stuff. So I definitely encourage all of that. In terms of the PayPal thing, that was just super interesting to see that like they deploy a smart contract with a version of Solidity that's like 5 years old, which like kind of makes me think that, hey, like maybe they wrote this code 5 years ago, put it on the shelf and then decided, oh shit, let's launch it now, and didn't even revisit it. That was super interesting. I got a lot of just funny shit posts and Twitter engagement out of that whole PayPal situation. A lot of people are upset that it's like centralized and they can like freeze funds and stuff like that. But that's pretty standard with other stable coins like Circle and stuff. I do think it's interesting. I think it'll bring a lot of people not really into Web3, but using Web3 kind of without really knowing a lot about it. But yeah.
I think that it's the Paxos code, right? So that's, I think that's part of why it's so old.
IUSD is super old.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend who has written a stablecoin for a major American financial institution. And of course, it's sitting there on the shelf, right? And that's, you know, it's ready to launch and has been for however long, but will they ever launch it, right? Like, who knows? So the whole just sitting there on the shelf is definitely a thing. And I have to contain myself because I want to tweet about it. Like, when are they going to launch it?
Why don't they update it like when they're going to launch it? Like, it's going to be in production at some point. So why not like 3-6 months before? No.
I mean, I feel like if they have to like go back and update it again, I feel like it's just going to have to go through like crazy reviews, like legal compliance and stuff again, probably.
So just like ship it, whatever.
I guess. Like, that's my interpretation of it.
That's funny. That's weird.
As I recall, the PayPal thing was actually going to launch on Sequelana, and then like they blew up or whatever. I don't know. And that's actually why it ended up not launching. Is I don't know, FTX, whatever. You are also a noted Sequelana critic. Maybe you don't use my nomenclature, but that's okay. I like my meme. I'm gonna stick with it. I guess what is it for you? Because you I don't know, you're up there in terms of noted critics with me.
Yeah, I mean, like, so for me, like, I don't really hate Solana that much. Like, a lot of this literally started as a joke. In full disclosure, when I worked at Magna, I wrote pretty much equally as many Solidity contracts as I did Rust for Solana, because Magna was multi-chain. But I absolutely hated the developer experience. Like, Rust with Anchor, like, framework, it felt like they were trying to make it as hard as possible for you. Like, it just seemed like a black box. They were abstracting so much stuff away from me. Who's to say, like, if I didn't do Solidity first and maybe I started with Solana, I'd be just shilling Solana right now. Probably not, but I'm really...
You'd be the single solitary dev on Solana.
I'd be the only dev on Solana, but I think it's funny that, like, I can write a shitpost about Solana and have the founder of Solana replying to it and getting angry about it, which I think it's hysterical. And like, it's great for engagement and stuff. And it's just funny to like every once in a while, like throw a quick jab. And I stand by the fact that I think Solana is the angriest community in crypto.
So yeah, good vibes only, as he says, of course, right? Like, it's such a gaslight. Pun intended. Trolley Tolley was not good vibes only. He got very obsessed with me and sent like his, you know, entire army of Potemkin Village of paid account trolls at me for like a while.
I do have to respect the people that just will never let stuff go. Like, in especially like in Web3, like crypto Twitter, it's like, I remember the day that like Pauly0x, he launched that token Pondcoin, and I broke the news. Like, I just wrote a tweet and I'm like, do not buy this token. Anyone can steal it from anyone else because they took a test version of a smart contract from Solady that allowed anyone to transfer anyone else's balance just whenever you wanted. So I tweeted that and it blew up, got like a million impressions, and all of his fans still to this day DM me, reply to me, and they're like, when are you going to retract that statement? Like, it was supposed to be in there. And I'm like, yeah, but like, it wasn't supposed to be in there. They launched a new token. Anyone that like bought that token with ETH on day one lost all of their money because everyone stole it. And to this day, it's been like 3 months. I'll get like a reply in a DM every day. It's like, retract the statement, say that you're a fake developer.
So you don't have anything like philosophical about Sequelana that specifically jibes with you, or, you know, just bad developer experience? And
I mean, it's, yeah, so it's bad developer experience. I do think it's funny that, like, what was it, like 10 to 15% of all Solana is like locked up with FTX. And obviously, like, it wouldn't happen this way, but I think the funniest outcome would be if, like, they were able to just, like, dump it all in a market order immediately and just, like, instantly send the price to zero. It'll obviously never happen, but, like, I would love to see that happen.
Yeah, it'll be like on the day of the pandemic where the price of oil went negative and so they were paying people in the futures market. All right, let's talk about L2, because I've been asking people for a while, like, when will people start caring about L2 gas? And I actually think our first interview, Will, was with Austin, and I asked him that. And he was like, whatever. And actually, that's basically what everyone has said until I asked you. And you said, oh, no, actually, a majority of our audits now are L2. Have you done any ZK rollup app optimization?
We haven't done any ZK rollup app stuff, though. But it's basically like some of our biggest customers have been on, you know, these L2s. There's really, like, I guess, three reasons why, like, someone on an L2 will want to, like, get an audit from us. First and foremost is, like, obviously, yes, base gas prices are lower. But if you're still doing, like, crazy bulk actions and stuff and tons of transactions a day, it's still going to stack up. So, like, obviously, you still want to, you know, reduce transaction costs. The other reason, and one of, like, the more important ones, is we say that, like, on mainnet Ethereum, we optimize for transaction costs. But on L2s, we optimize for transaction computation ability. So, like, these L2s, you still have 30 million gas units per block. That can make the difference between, can you batch mint 100 things, or if we optimize for you, can you batch mint 1,000 things? And that really comes down to, like, user experience. Like, someone on a dApp, they have to sign as few transactions as possible. If we just, like, cycle slowly back to what I said, though, about, like, optimizing for transaction costs on an L2, call data is super expensive on an L2. You're going to post the call data back to the L1. And we do a lot. Fortunately, Optimizer has written a library in Solidity called, I think it's just called Solidity.js, but we're basically compressing call data, which is really, really nice. And, like, it's optimizing there. And then the last reason why someone on an L2 will reach out to us is they're on an L2 because they think they can only be on an L2. So they think that, like, the way that their contracts are, the way that their code behaves, it's just way too expensive to be on an L1. And the most prime example we had of that was we did a large scale audit with Radiant Capital, like, super early on when I started doing this. And we were able to optimize a lot of their flows up to 88% for some of their super expensive actions. And I mean, it seemed like from inception, Radiant always thought we have to be on an L2. But I did these optimizations, they ran the numbers, and they were able to make a DAO proposal, and they're going to be deploying to ETH mainnet now, which is sick, because it's like, for some of these L2s, we can unlock more liquidity for them, because obviously the liquidity will always be on ETH mainnet. You have to go through the trouble of, like, oh, so you have to get MetaMask, and you have to bridge and stuff, and, like, nobody new wants to do that. But yeah, those are really the three reasons why, like, L2 gas is important. So anyone that tweets, like, oh, we're on an L2, it doesn't matter, like, that's not true.
I hear you saying as well is that basically it's not that much of a difference to optimize for L2, which surprises me.
Yeah, I mean, so, like, a lot of the times, like, obviously compute on an L2 is way less, just like the base gas costs and stuff, but we're still doing the same quality of audit every single time. Even though compute is not that important on an L2, we're still optimizing your protocol the same we would on mainnet, if not more, because we're doing these optimizations at the dApp level, where we're actually compressing your call data beforehand. Like, I think that, like, L2s will continue to be more and more of our revenue just because so many companies are building on L2s, they're building these casinos, Web3 games and stuff. And I think that they'll start to wonder as we work with more companies, like, hey, could we actually do this on ETH mainnet? Is this feasible on ETH mainnet?
We have EigenLayer and all these other things going on. How are you thinking about that from a development standpoint? I feel like the treadmill is just, like, increasing in pace always, and that's why we always have these hacks, right? And that's why auditors are so expensive. And now we're talking not only about, like, L2s, but we're talking about, like, restaking and restaking primitives and all the things that are going to be built on that. as an auditor, how do you even like start like grokking those ideas?
Yeah, I mean, it's super hard. Like, I can't stay on top of everything. Like, as much as I would like to, I work crazy hours. I can't stay on top of everything. So like when these new things come out, I really have to like kind of learn it on the job as I'm doing an audit. I'm like, oh, I've never seen this library before. Like, let me put a couple hours in beforehand to like look at this or like read about this new protocol and stuff. Like, as an auditor, and more specifically being the only gas auditor, it's like a nightmare.
When do you think you'll get competition?
So we actually kind of almost have competition. So like super early on in Gaslight, this fund basically wanted to acquire us like a weekend for some like mega predatory offer. And I'm like, I'm not giving my company away right now. So recently they spun up like a consulting group to do gas optimization, but have seen nothing come out of them yet. But I want competition, like, because all it's going to do is just like solidify like how important gas optimization is. And also at the end of the day, it's like, I don't care if I'm making less money. I care that like everyone is, you know, everyone has efficient smart contracts. And the biggest thing is like right now, I hate that I have to turn someone away and they don't get gas optimization.
Did you raise money? Like, you had a tweet about that. I wasn't sure if it was a joke or not. Were you trying to raise money?
If I tweeted anything about that, it was a joke. We haven't raised money.
Okay, because I was like, you're clearly making money, right? So,
no, we're fully bootstrapped and have been profitable literally since like day one. Like, there's really no expenses other than like random payroll stuff we pay for, like Slack.
And so, like, what is the? I guess maybe first we should, before I talk about vision for Gaslight, because you've hinted at it, and maybe you're not going to give it away here, but. Before we get into that, like, tell us about Drop. Like, was there one specific moment where you're like, we have to do a gas efficient airdrop product? I can't take it anymore.
Yeah. So actually, this isn't even my first like efficient airdrop that I wrote. So when I was working at Magna, we launched WEN tokens, basically. Like, I think The Block did a story about it. We launched it like at ETH Denver. And it was just an efficient airdrop for ERC-20s and ERC-721s. Just ERC-20 and ETH. And then that was back in February or March. And I've learned so much more since then. And I'm like, I want to redo this. I want to save more gas. And I want to add the ability to airdrop NFTs, because there's a bunch of airdrop tools out there in general that just are A, inefficient, and B, for some reason, charge you like a base fee for every like NFT. So it's like, you want to airdrop 1,000 NFTs. Oh, you also have to pay $7,000, which is absurd to me. So that was really the big motivation for like rewriting WEN tokens, was like, I want a new app, I want a new smart contract that supports NFTs, because there's literally no good way to batch send NFTs. So I had like a break for like a week, and I just wrote it, built it, got it audited, and shipped it.
By the way, I should point out to the people who are listening that you have a very cool Gaslight neon sign behind you.
And a hat.
And a hat.
Yeah. He's living the brand.
And
already.
A m'lady shirt, I think. I can't.
And a m'lady t-shirt. There is no meme.
I thought.
Can you explain the m'lady thing to me? Because I do feel like that is tied into your brand, and I don't understand it at all. Sorry. Yeah, like something about, it's like, what, optimizers are all m'ladies because of you, because of somebody else? Like, what's going on here?
Okay, so for the longest time, I was so against NFTs. I'm like, they're so dumb. And then I just started to see like a bunch of really cool, like when I joined Twitter, a bunch of really smart developers that I was learning a lot from had this profile picture, and I'm like, what the hell is this? Find out it's a m'lady, and I start seeing it more and more, and I'm like, I start to like kind of get deep in like their lore and culture. And it's like, the whole thing with m'lady is it's really like the antithesis of NFTs. Like, they promise no utility, they're not like building all this like cringe stuff. And it's just like a bunch of people that like don't really care. They all like have the same image. They recommend that if you can't afford one, you just copy and paste someone else's. Like, I think it's really just like the funniest thing, because it's like anti-NFT culture. So yeah, I mean, I bought it, and I've met so many of like these people just like at events that they throw like IRL. And it's just like on the timelines, they're psychopaths. But in person, it's like some of the like nicest people that I've ever met.
Didn't they just get like busted as a co-founder was a Fed or something?
Yeah.
All the co-founders are suing each other.
Yeah, they dropped the lawsuit on 9/11, so it's called M'lady 9/11.
Oh my goodness.
That does seem very NFT project right there, though.
Yeah, that
like
is.
Everybody's suing each other.
Yeah, that's like the thing is like you gotta like expect like they're running like an 8-figure business. Like obviously it's gonna be like incorporated. Like it's gonna be an LLC, right? Like I don't know what these people thought.
That's too much.
Right on. Okay, so tell us about the vision for Gaslight.
Yeah, so I mean, I have like so much stuff that's going to be announced like in a month, so I'm just trying to make sure I don't leak anything. But
you should though.
Nobody watches our show anyway. Don't worry about it.
So even a taste would be nice.
So like basically, like what I can say is like Gaslight started as gas audits, but like that's like just the beginning.
Will that be more products, more education, just all of that?
More m'ladies.
Going to be everything. Everything.
We did get a question on Twitter about you being Anon, but you're clearly not Anon.
Yeah, and, that's the thing.
That's just like, a lady.
I don't know why people like think that I'm anonymous. Just like I'm fully doxxed. If you just search Gaslight on LinkedIn, like you'll see my full name, where I went to high school, like everything. I've never wanted to be anonymous, but for some reason, like people tweet at me and they're like, "Why don't you ever like post what you look like?" And I'm like, I do that like pretty often.
Yeah. Well, I retweeted this episode out with a picture of you, so you're doxxed.
Oh, perfect.
One way or the other.
The 182 tattoo. Are you a big Blink 182 fan?
So the 182 tattoo is literally like I am the biggest Blink 182 fan of all time. I saw them twice on their reunion tour in New York City. Like, yeah, so many people ask me. They're like, "What does 182 mean?" I'm like, look at me. I have like a dangly like cross ear and stuff. Like clearly it's Blink 182.
Yeah, I the fact that people wanted to know that, I was like, what else could it be? But I figured I'd ask. And I feel like asking the cringe question about, you know, do you drive a car and whether it's an electric vehicle, I have to ask as well.
So I do drive a car and it is a Tesla. But
he lives his values. Wow. Indeed.
I do. I did, though. I moved 3 months ago to Brooklyn, so I don't really need the car anymore. So it's like back where I used to live, and I'm going to be selling it because I don't need it. But yes, I really did practice what I preached. No gas.
Oh, how's Brooklyn so far? That's actually a good capping question. I feel like you walk down there and you'll just hear like Eigenlayer on the street corner. You'll hear like people talk about NFTs in a cafe. It's just like, yeah, especially Williamsburg.
So I'm in Bushwick. I don't really hear as much about that.
Okay.
I have met like a ton of people randomly in Bushwick that are into crypto. Like one day I tweeted a picture from like the local coffee shop I go to every morning, and someone that follows me replied, and he's like, "Dude, that's the coffee shop I go to every day. I live 2 blocks away. Like, come hang out." And I just like pulled up to his apartment.
I'm just sort of curious. Is somebody like, I made a joke to Vitalik when we interviewed him about like nobody who is like relatively new to this space. And you're not really new to the space, but you didn't do Solidity until 2021. Like, you probably don't run into consensus people at all, despite living in Bushwick.
I don't think I ever have. The one thing I did see is in my my local grocery store last night, was shopping with my girlfriend, and she goes, "Look, he has a Solana tote bag." And that was tough.
They give those to everybody.
Did you say anything?
No, I didn't. I'm a coward.
All right. On that note, we'll end this recording. Thank you for joining us. And any closing words aside from gas bad?
I mean, obviously gas bad. And then the last thing is like, we need more people in serious roles shitposting on Twitter. It's fun for everyone. I encourage everyone to just shitpost on Twitter.
Amazing.